Hello and welcome to The Review, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Coming up on today's programme, we're in Rio, where the city has been transformed even more than usual into a gigantic open-air art gallery.
I believe that we have created a sense of innovation, a sense of possibility of change, and also a dialogue with the world that we are open and we are ready to establish a new conversation.
Also ahead, we'll be taking a cultural round-the-world trip with our guide, Nelly Gocheva.
Tokyo's International Film Festival opens today with over 300 films from 91 countries competing for the Tokyo Sakura Grand Prix.
Our musical guest this week is a Finnish producer who has worked with everything from the most hardcore of punk to the most polished of pop.
And we'll meet a publisher who believes Dutch literature's moment in the sun has arrived.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
Welcome to Studio One, Andrew Muller.
Welcome back. We haven't been here for 12 hours.
It's great fun. I missed it. So much so I had to come back and do the review. We abandoned the fast-paced mania of the daily and we've taken a more leisurely approach and looking at the cultural highlights of each other's weeks. What was yours?
I read a book, which is not that unusual, but it was a book we actually talked about here on the review a couple of weeks ago when we were going through what was interesting in the world of publishing. It's D.T. Max's Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, which is a biography of David Foster Wallace. It's quite interesting in that you get the sense that while he remained throughout the book enthralled by David Foster Wallace's work, which, you know, was and is extraordinary, he grew to rather dislike the author of the work.
Oh, no.
And David Foster Wallace, it has to be said, does come across as a not necessarily terribly likable human being. But it's a very, very, yeah, it's beautifully written, and he doesn't, the temptation must have been terrible to try and write a biography of David Foster Wallace occasionally lapsing into the kind of recursive self-referential style of David Foster Wallace, but he doesn't do that. He just tells the story very straight and with commendable discipline, I thought.
My cultural highlight of the week was discovering Homeland for the first time. I am a notoriously late adopter when it comes, well, to pretty much most things in this world. And I am terrible at coming to drama series about two or three series in and wondering what all the fuss is about. And I think it's perhaps because Homeland is being reported now as having the second series problem, that it is not as good as it first was.
See, I thought the first series was really silly.
You see, I missed the first series, so my expectations were incredibly high for the second series, and I walked in, and as has been mentioned quite a bit on Monocle in the last 24 hours, given the recent events in Beirut, there has been criticism that the last episode was based in Beirut, totally not only misrepresented Beirut, but just seemed to be, I don't know, kind of lacking in edge. I was quite astonished by that because I was wondering whether. Is it one of those difficult second series syndromes that once a series has got so established, people actually expect less from what they're going to be watching?
I'm possibly not the most informed source on this because I got two episodes into the much ballyhooed first series and thought, this is just silly and I don't care.
What was it that made you find that silly?
Everything, the plot, everything. Basically. Everything. I just wasn't buying it. However, I did subsequently watch the Israeli series Prisoners of War, on which Homeland is based, and which is absolutely amazing.
Why and how does it differ from Homeland?
The characters just struck me as little less cartoonish and a lot more ambiguous, and it unspooled the idea of what was going on much more slowly. Mm. I think it expected and demanded a bit more of the viewer. I think, was what the difference was in Prisoners of War.
Homeland did demand so little from the viewer this last week. And there were just huge gaps in it. There was one really good final set piece, which involved a sort of an emergency room situation. And that had its moment of drama. It almost echoed scenes of Obama watching the assassination of Osama bin Laden. And obviously, I think that that was a key thing to include in any kind of drama like Homeland. Mm. But I do wonder whether they are just ticking the boxes slightly now. Anyway, we shall see. We shall see whether it improves. I know it's not had a particularly warm reception in the United Kingdom in the last few days. So we shall talk. We shall. Maybe I shall just abandon it, and that will be the only one episode of Homeland that I ever watch. Still.
Anyway, you are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be right back after this. And we start today in Brazil. Rio de Janeiro is, of course, home to one of the most famous pieces of public art in the world, the statue of Christ the Redeemer, which watches over the city from the peak of the Corcovado Mountain. But the tradition continues at lower altitudes. The city has a collection of nearly 600 works on display in its plazas, parks and streets.
And the OIR Festival aims to both extend and celebrate this tradition. The Other Ideas for Rio Festival, to give it its full name, encourages what it calls intervention by international artists in Rio's most famous locations. Regular host of the weekend edition, Georgina, has upped sticks and travelled to Rio to see the project. She caught up with Marcelo Dantas, who's curator of Other Ideas for Rio.
It's a public art series of commissions of new works that are taking place all around the city of Rio de Janeiro. And it's six artists invited from several different countries creating works in the public sphere, in relating to the nature, relating to the urban aspects of the city, relating to different sites in outdoors in the city of Rio. Rio is a city that has been marked by its great tradition of welcoming foreign artists in trying to develop an identity for the city. I mean, throughout the centuries, I mean, we have always welcomed, you know, other forms of expression into the texture of the city. And a few examples are very strong, and the very icon of the city, the Christ in the Mountain, is itself a piece of public art placed there 80 years ago. So we envision a project that we will be inviting people that have never worked in Rio to create works that relate to the architecture, to the landscape, to the urban situation, to the context of the city. And that's what this project is about.
Just explain where we are in the context of the city.
Yeah, well, this is this aqueduct is a landmark of the city. It's been here for almost 300 years. And it is also the birthplace of gafieira, the dancing sort of tango style. Then you have Circo Voador, which is the birthplace of Brazilian rock, just across from the arches. Then you have Fundição, which is also a birthplace for a lot of the avant-garde movements of the 80s in Brazil. Then you have the Cathedral, which is the place for liturgical music, music related, religious music. Then you have Sala Cecília Meirelles, which is the place for classical music, and you have the School of Music, and then you have the Opera House, all within one block. This is the place for music.
Tell me about Goldsworthy's work, because he's the British site-specific sculptor. What's he making?
Well, he made a clay dome that he spent over a month here developing, and you go inside. I went inside. It's really magnificent. Until it did collapse. Part of the work.
It wasn't meant to collapse.
Well, it is. All his work is meant to be to disappear. You know, he has only a few, very few pieces in his entire career. He made over 4,000 works, and I think less than 10 of them are permanent. Most of them are temporary. I mean, they are fragile in nature. And a work made of clay of that nature would eventually collapse. It did collapse. And also, well, it became very beautiful when it collapsed as well, because it also showed that energy between you trying to make the earth make something and the earth saying back to you, I don't want it. So it conceptually, it's a very strong piece.
One of the most iconic views of Rio is your Sugarloaf Mountain.
Yeah.
And you have completely subverted that view, according to some of the complainants writing to your local newspapers. Tell me about that work.
I mean, because we put Jaume Plensa's work right in there. I think this was the place for it to be. His initial idea was to put it in Ipanema, but obviously the waves of Ipanema make it impossible to put a sculpture in the water, because the waves will eventually destroy the sculpture. And then I proposed to him, I mean, why don't we go to where we don't have any waves and where we have a lot of very strong, iconic background? And proposed to him, and it was very nice that it did work. And we put this 12-meter-high head coming out of the water. And what I find to be interesting in there is that this idea of a girl coming out of the water, big girl, like, which is can be the mermaid, which can be the Yemanja figure. It's in many, many, many different cultures, and he worked with a completely different approach to it, and it impacted people very strongly. Some people felt that we were destroying the postcards of Rio. I mean, this is a temporary work. We're not destroying anything. We're coming up with this completely. It's fine. We're putting a 2 months period in. Whenever we take it away, people are going to actually feel the absence of it, I think. But I think what is very strong is that it proved the power of, you know, it is very difficult to create a sculpture with the context of a city of this scale. When you have a mountain of 500 meters high on your background, and then you make a sculpture. I mean, what size of a sculpture can it be? What kind of thing can it be? He actually made something that subverted the very notion that you have, that it turned something that was protagonist in something that was a background. And this is a very powerful thing for art to do.
How long will the project run?
For 2 months, but the project is at 3 editions every 2 years. So we'll do 6 commissions now, 6 in 2014 and 6 in 2016. 6 for the World Cup and 6 for the Olympics. We want to do these many editions. Maybe we're going to create a different type of project afterwards, but this is the project, I mean, to do it biannually. And it runs for 2 months in the end of the year.
What do you hope, finally, to have created, to leave as your legacy from Other Ideas for Rio?
I believe that we have created a sense of innovation, a sense of possibility, of change, and also a dialogue with the world, that we are open and we are ready to establish a new conversation, that we are open for people to bring in new ideas and innovate in this context.
And one of the artists involved in OIR is noted polymath Brian Eno, whose work there opened last night. And as we heard earlier on the weekend edition, before he set sail to Brazil, Brian joined Georgina here at Midori House to tell her about his project.
They invited me to be involved somehow in the city, and they had seen a piece that I did in Australia at the Sydney Opera House, where I painted the whole of the exterior of the Opera House with light. And this is part of a series of works I've done called 77 Million Paintings, which are generative works, that's to say, ever-changing, self-making pictures, really. And they asked me if I would do something similar to that in Rio. So they said, and here's a choice of 149 places where you can do it. Something like that. It was a huge number of sites that they offered, up mountains and inside museums and art schools and street corners. And in fact, the place I chose was a large aqueduct on a very popular square in Rio, a square where people have met for years to demonstrate or dance or do all the sorts of things that people do out in large numbers in public. So I'm actually going there on Monday to see whether my plan works.
And that was Brian Eno. On the plane with him was Georgina Godwin, who joins us on the line from Rio now. Welcome to the review, Georgina. Lovely to hear from you. You were at the opening last night of Other Ideas for Rio. What kind of press build-up had there been there beforehand?
Well, it was absolutely massive. There was a press conference here, and about 14 or 15 papers carried the result of that the next day. Sadly, what they carried wasn't exactly what happened, though, because there's one thing that everybody knows about Brian Eno, even if you're not a great fan of ambient music or you don't know his previous work, almost everybody knows that he was involved with Roxy Music. Now, for him, this was such a tiny, tiny part of his career. He's had a long and illustrious time in the music industry, and I think he made only 2 albums with Roxy Music. In the end, but there's always, kind of grimly, inevitably, there's always a question about it in any press conference. And he was asked at this conference whether a big reunion tour was on the cards, and what he said was, "I'd rather have hot nails driven through my balls." However, in English, of course, nails is just one word. In Portuguese, prego is nails for carpentry, and unha is nails that you have on the end of your fingernails.
Right.
And people got a little bit coy about saying balls in the newspaper as well.
I can see where this is going.
how it was reported when they were talking about a potential love-in with Brian Ferry and a reunion tour of Roxy Music was that I would like to have fingernails on my body.
on his body.
Exactly. that actually makes it sound like it's a negotiable proposition, doesn't it? That he's actually up for doing the reunion, but his price is
a bit of a tickle.
Is a bit of a tickle. It's fingernails on his body. There'll be millions of excited Roxy Music fans all over Brazil.
He did go on to say that he admires tremendously everybody within Roxy Music. He just doesn't want to be retrogressive about his career and wants to move forward.
Brian Eno wanting a tickle notwithstanding, there has been a large cultural event which has sadly been diverting people's attention from the opening, hasn't there?
Oh, totally. It's been the last installment of Avenida Brasil, which is the most popular telenovela for years on television here. I mean, to the point where the electricity companies were expecting enormous surges in power last night. So it's been absolutely huge. And it's been that the climate, as Brian himself pointed out, in America you have soap operas that look at rich people. In Britain, the soap operas are about poor people. And in Brazil, they seem to be about when rich meets poor. And this particular one, Avenida Brasil, is about that sort of exploiting that fault line, if you like, along the socioeconomic divide. And so people got very, very into it. And last night was the final episode. So people thought, well, nobody's going to turn up to watch this, to see the 77 million paintings. And bizarrely, there were hundreds of people there, which I think is very healthy. It's a very healthy indicator of how people view public art and culture in Brazil, that they will actually come up, or perhaps that they've all got video recorders.
I mean, Rio has a tradition of public art, of course, but how much are they adding to it in this festival? How big a deal? I mean, what sort of difference is it making to Rio's streetscape?
I think it's absolutely enormous. I mean, just staying on the subject of television, there were news helicopters and things hovering above the latter, place, the square in which it's taken place. So the kind of live news coming from it, it's lighting up the entire city. And then you've got this enormous head, as we were hearing earlier, in front of the Sugarloaf, all these various sort of art installations around the city. And for people, I think for this particular piece, in a city as busy as Rio, it's great to have something, a sort of tranquil thing that you can dip into and sit there and just kind of be. And of course, it's all completely free. So you had all sorts of people there, from tramps to, in fact, the lead actress in the soap that went out last night. So she actually wasn't watching herself. She came down had a look. Carolina Ferraz, her name is. So I think in terms of affecting the city, very, very much so. It was quite funny, speaking to people around the venue, a lot of them thought that the aqueduct being lit up had something to do with the soap opera. For some reason, the two seem to have got confused in people's minds.
And focusing just briefly on Brian Eno's event, you've seen the rehearsals. How are all things expected to go down?
You know, very, very well. As I say, lovely just to have something you can dip in and out of. For me, I don't think that I can spend 3 hours just watching very slowly changing light and the very kind of relaxing ambient music. That's just because I've got a very short attention span. But I think what's great for people is that you can dip in and out, that you can sit in the square having a party with your mates, watching this fantastic changing vista, or you can sit and absolutely concentrate on it for the 3 hours that it's on every night.
And to finally round up with a very British question, the weather forecast is not expected to be very good, though, is it?
You know what? It doesn't seem to matter. What happens when it rains on the aqueduct is just that it makes everything really shiny and it throws up reflections. Of course, the audience get wet, but I'm not particularly concerned about that because I've got an umbrella. I'm British.
Don't start me on umbrellas. I think they're instruments of the devil and should be scoured from the face of the earth. But other than that, Georgina, thank you very much for joining us. This is The Review on Monocle 24. We'll shortly be finding out what else is happening around the world.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we head to Istanbul's inaugural Design Biennial. We poke around Lisbon's first open house weekend. And we go shopping with Shanghai gallerist Pearl Lam at the Pavilion of Art and Design in London.
Industrial design has been really important when we look at the Bauhaus, starting from Bauhaus time, because each of the design, each of the technology represent a certain time in history, reflecting economic, political and social.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. And it's time now to offer succour to anyone at a loose end for the next 2 days who is in the mood for travel. Here's Nelly Gacheva with a roundup of this weekend's best bits.
This weekend in London, the annual Wildlife Photographer of the Year exhibition opens at the Natural History Museum. The 100 winning photos feature topics from microscopic life and rare landscapes to soaring eagles and prowling wildcats. And they were selected from 8,000 photographic entries from 98 countries. For more details, visit nhm.ac.uk. If in Helsinki this weekend, stop by Design Forum Finland to check out Raidu, an exhibition of modern and traditional Sami craft. Handmade products by designers Marit Magga, Ritva Tamela, and many more will be on display, outlining old and proven local traditions. Produced by Sami Education Institute that provides training in Sami arts and craft, the show will be at Design Forum Finland until the 3rd of November, and then traveling around the region. Tokyo's International Film Festival opens today with over 300 films from 91 countries competing for the Tokyo Sakura Grand Prix. Founded in 1985, the festival is now in its 25th edition. We recommend director Karin Nugroho's low-budget film The Blindfold and Benoît Jacob's period drama Farewell My Queen. And back in London, Indian-born art photographer Brijesh Patel is showing his latest work at the Great Eastern Bear Gallery. The exhibition features landscapes and portraits from everyday life in southern Norway. And for your weekend soundtrack, we suggest the latest album, Daughter of Cloud, by American Rockers of Montreal. It's a must-listen to compilation of the band's unreleased songs from the past 5 years. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gacheva.
How can it be done? How can we escape from this indigent state? We've traveled so long, and now I'm afraid it might happen too late.
And that was of Montreal, who are in fact of Athens, Georgia, with Psychotic Feeling from their new album of offcuts and outtakes, Daughter of Cloud, which is released on Monday. And it's time now for our weekly music review. Today we're joined by a Finnish DJ, musician and producer whose eclectic, restless ear has been brought to bear upon everything from hardcore punk to classic pop to what, in at least one instance, was intriguingly characterised as spacey gnostic disco.
We'll ask him more about spacey gnostic disco in just a moment, but for the time being, Timo Kaupolampi, thank you very much indeed for joining us today in the studio for the review. A very warm welcome.
Thank you
very
much.
What brings you to the United Kingdom at the moment?
We are preparing the release of KXP, my band's second album, and I went to Manchester to see my record label.
Your record label is based in the United Kingdom. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, if you want to have like a global world domination plan, it's pretty good to start it from Manchester.
Do you think there is...
I'd agree with that. I'm from the city, so...
But yeah. Is it difficult to launch, even this in this interconnected world now, is it difficult to launch a musical career from Finland?
I think it's relatively, like, difficult, but you just have to try for years and you know, hit your head into a wall and suddenly there's a little crack and then your head is cracking and then you keep on hitting your head. And I think it's really difficult.
Why is that? Are there just no record labels which have an external view?
I think it's just that there's so many bands and I think that's it, that there's so much, like, things happening. And that's why you have to be really original if you want to stand out from the rest of them.
I mean, is there a sort of that compare? I mean, I grew up in a small remote country myself, Australia, and there was always this kind of competitive scramble among Australian groups to try and get overseas, to try and get any sort of foothold in Europe or the United States or in the United Kingdom. Is it like that in Finland as well, or is there a sort of self-contained scene which is just happy to exist among itself just in Finland?
I think it was really difficult, like maybe late 90s, beginning of 2000, but after that, it's been getting a little bit easier and easier all the time. But I think you just have to have like a very, very, like, a spirit that you want to do it over a few years. So you're not like first time you come and playing London, for example, it's always, but you need to build it up from the bottom.
And you've done this by releasing music under lots and lots of different names. Why did you tell us a little bit more about that? Who you've been, whose name you have used, and why you've chosen to take that approach?
Well, I think this is also one problem that I'm still trying to break, because I've just been having very schizophrenic back catalog.
Right.
So it's like I started with the kind of psychedelic 60s garage rock thing with what's called And the Left-Handed. And we got really, like, a little bit buzz, and Errol Alkan was putting us on his compilations and stuff like that.
So that all sounded good?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Then I had a band called Opal Bastards. Can you say bastards in the radio?
I think you just have.
Okay, thank you. John Peel was saying it, so...
That's absolutely fine.
Okay, we're cool. So that was another thing that we were doing. And then I kind of got...
Why did... But you know, you said you just had a schizophrenic issue. You were doing And the Left-Handed, and then you did Opal Bastards. What made you change direction?
Well, this is the thing. I really don't know. I think it's so fun to create something rather than to follow it up for a longer period of time.
Have you ever thought of putting all these acts on the same bill? You could be your own festival.
Yeah, but it's going to be exhausting to play, like...
And, that would get tiring. But if like most festivals, you did it over several days.
Yeah, that would be fun.
That would be great.
But not
fun
yet. I think something like in the very far future, it must be possible to do that kind of thing.
And you've been exploring different musical genres as well along the way.
Yeah, all the time. But I tried to make my own slice. I'm not interested of like... I started from like copying first, like really... puristically, like a 60s, like garage rock, and you know, that kind of like Sonics and Music Machine and that kind of stuff. But like very soon, I fed up with like copying, because I realized I was listening to Stooges, Iggy and the Stooges, and I just realized that they were so original at the time, and that's why they're standing the test of time so good, that they just like they're so amazingly original. And also what was really big influence was when I was reading that when Kraftwerk had an off day in their tour, they went to see Iggy and the Stooges live. So I wanted to somehow combine Kraftwerk and Iggy and the Stooges.
Okay, well, the best way to figure out if you've managed that, I think, is to play a track by one of the tracks you've brought us. This is KXP. I believe this is called Easy Infinity Waits.
Yeah.
This is your project, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about KXP before we hear a piece
okay,
of music.
Okay, it's like KXP happened on the moment when I was totally fed up with all the bands and I just wanted to scrap them all and not to do any more bands.
These are the bands that you had been doing?
Yeah.
Right.
So I was not like... So then KXP happened and there's something... It's for a long time I was just doing electronic things, and then I went back into the whole like drums and bass and electronic kind of beats, kind of morphing everything together, taking electric guitar out of the equation. To be honest, I think somehow if you have a band with drums, bass and electric guitar, somehow that should be like illegal in 2012.
Sure,
because it's so many bands.
What do you do in your spare time, Andrew Muller?
Nothing.
There's so many bands with that core, like same, like instrumentation, and I just like I always like to argue that if that's is that the only thing that there is that the band.
Andrew, what would you say to that?
I think the limitations can be a virtue as well. I think that's where people's originality can be brought to bear on those sort of much more orthodox forms that you're talking about. It's like having to sort of work within a template but finding new ways to express yourself within that template. Once there's kind of rules and forms and ideas and traditions, you can also have fun with those.
Yeah, I do agree.
Okay, well, let's try one of your tracks. This is KXP. This is Easy, Infinity Waits.
That was KXP and Easy. That's the work of Timo Kaukolampi, our music reviewer, who joins us in the studio on today's review. Timo, that's a really interesting mix. I heard a little bit of Nine Inch Nails from the 1990s in there, but it has a real pop drive behind it, doesn't
it? Yeah, I've been said that that's something that I do really naturally. And on a first KXP record, I always was hiding the pop under lots of noise and distortion and oscillators and synthesizers and lots of random stuff. But with this record, I think it's very honest that I a little bit bring that more up into the surface.
It put me very much in mind, and this is incredibly obscure and to stop me. There's a mid-1980s New Zealand band called Snapper who made a couple of quite cultish records on the Flying Nun label. A similar kind of thing, that kind of big suicide variety synthesizer sound with a big pop tune on top of it. I really like that.
Check it out. Interesting.
Have you ever thought, exploring all the genres that you have done in your career, the great thing that you write such a strong pop tune there, have you ever thought about doing pure pop and seeing where it went?
I am practicing that. I'm practicing that.
I get the impression that you'd quite like to break it round the edges, though, before you released it on the world.
Yeah, I think the thing with pop music is very tricky. You can talk about pop music without it really being pop music. Like, I think pop music is only pop music when it becomes popular. Do you see what I mean? So, as a music maker, I can't choose if I make pop music or not pop music. I can just make music, and if it becomes popular, it's pop music. So this is what I think I feel very strongly about, that I just have to make interesting stuff. And of course, I can bear in mind that I have the little hooks and melodies and like interesting things there. But I think for me, the best pop hits in the world is like, you know, Popcorn by Hot Butter. I like the Hot Butter better than I think the original. But like, you know, that kind of really obscure or Lieutenant Pigeon, the moldy old dough. Do you remember
that? Yes.
That's like, it was a huge track.
But it's one of the infuriating mysteries of writing the pop song, though. Everybody knows the tricks and the hooks and the formulas, but still it's really impossible to know why one song all of a sudden becomes a massive hit and hundreds of others are just never heard from again.
Yeah. But at the risk of making this sound like we give Timo career advice here on the review, you were talking about the difficulty that Finland has in exporting its music because there are so many bands. I immediately thought that there is not one great pop artist that's come out of Finland that could break a global market.
Whereas any number of come from Sweden.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I think it is a little bit, I would say that maybe already when ABBA was happening, I think it was bigger than, if you think measure it with money, it was bigger than Volvo, I heard.
Yeah, yeah.
That it was more like capital moving that with Volvo. What I think is that little bit Swedes are a little bit ahead in the game. So I think it might be that Finns are a little bit catching up with that. But I would also say that in this time we are living now, I think it's difficult also to break a pop act.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit about the second track you've chosen. This is Kahim Kari.
Yeah.
With a song called Son of a Gun. Who is Kahim Kari?
Kahim Kari is a Japanese superstar.
Okay.
Let's have a listen to her. And that was Kahima Karie, Son of a Gun, the choice of Timo Kaukolampi, our guest on today's review. And when I heard that, the first thing I thought was she would make a great artist on a Sofia Coppola soundtrack.
Yeah,
she
that's
has that sort
true.
Of Japanese-French influence over her, a little bit Breathless, but also that sort of Velvet Undergroundy twang. Why do you like her so much?
Well, I think this is a very interesting track itself because I think it was originally made by a Scottish band called Vaselines. And then Nirvana made a really big version of it, I think.
Yeah, there were a couple of Vaseline's tracks on that Nirvana Unplugged thing. Yeah. I think that was the biggest result the Vaseline's ever had.
Yeah. And then I think this Kahim Kari track is like for maybe like 90s, late 90s. And I think this is produced by this guy called Momus. He's some kind of like a pop, intellect pop. But for me, it's just so very... Because the track actually starts with this kind of very harsh, like oscillator, synthesizer, drones.
It's actually quite close to that spacey gnostic disco we were talking
about. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
what is spacey gnostic disco?
Is gnostic a little bit like gothic or... Yeah. No, that's like...
Anyway, if anything, if you'll go... That was sort of what I had in my head. I think we can get too caught up in the phrase spacey gnostic disco.
We can get too caught up.
It just tickled me.
I mean, you're a DJ in Finland as well. What do you decide to play? Would something like Kahim Kari be part of your set?
Yes, I would call myself rather that. I just go out and play good tunes. I can't say that I'm a real like beat mixing DJ. I have my strong point in playing live, and I think. DJing can be very difficult sometimes if you are... Well, I used to work on a radio in Finland, in Radio Helsinki, and I had my weekly show where I was playing totally random stuff on the Sunday evenings. And I think I have a little bit of like experience of that. But I just play tracks that I like really and I don't know how to explain it.
You mentioned John Peel a little earlier on. Who are your influences in DJing?
I would say... When I was in Optimo Club in Glasgow, and I heard the guys Keith and Johnny mixing AC/DC guitar solo to Ron Trent techno record Altered States, and there was all the LEDs of the mixer was on the red, and it was never coming down. I was totally blown away.
You're a happy man.
I was totally happy man. I never heard anything like it. It was like some early AC/DC record together with techno, and it was so amazing.
Well, we should sign off, I guess, with your third choice. This is Marjan with Kavir Adel. Could you introduce it briefly?
Yeah, it's an Iranian, I think, Iranian singer, and I think it's very interesting because it sounds so much like Finnish schlager at the same time.
Okay.
I just think it's very, very beautiful and somehow very, very warm feeling.
Okay, Timo Karkalampi, an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
This is your final track. This is Mayan with Kaveh Erdel.
تو شکست تاج غرورم، با توی چشمه روشن، بی توی جادم که سوت و کورم، ای که به شب هم صبح سپیدی، بی تو کبیری بی شام،
and our thanks to Timo Karkalampi for choosing that piece of music, Mayan by, no, that was Kaveh Erdel by Mayan, here on Monocle 24. Well, we heard a little earlier on from Nelly Gocheva about some cultural highlights happening around the world. For today's city look ahead, we head to Berlin, where our correspondent Kimberly Bradley talks us through what's happening in her city in the coming days.
As always, Berlin's got a ton of culture on in the upcoming week. Some of the best things, though, are longer festivals and attractions that are ending right about now. So it's the perfect time to take that last opportunity to catch them. This weekend, Berlin's annual Festival of Lights, a 10-day event in which 70 of the city's historical buildings are creatively illuminated, draws to a close. Make sure tonight to catch the multicolored Brandenburg Gate, or the always psychedelic patterns thrown onto the Berlin Cathedral. One of the best ways to see lots of lit-up attractions is to take a ride across town on bus number 100. It's also the last week of a month-long performing arts festival called Foreign Affairs, which spotlights international artists from nearly all corners of the world. At the Berliner Festspiele, on the city's west side, don't miss Italian director Romeo Castellucci's The Four Seasons Restaurant. It's the German premiere of a dance theatrical piece that's billed as an act of rejection as an homage to Mark Rothko. Also in the city's western districts is the Deutsche Oper, where German composer Richard Wagner's Parsifal premieres in a new production directed by Philipp Stolzel and conducted by Scottish conductor Donald Runicles. This year is the Deutsche Oper's 100th anniversary. Its building, with an exterior so brutalist that locals call it Sing Sing, is holding its own, even though the state opera is temporarily around the corner until its east side building is renovated. Another thing to definitely catch before it ends are the official celebrations of Berlin's 775th anniversary. Interesting exhibitions, and even excavations tracing the city's history, are still on view 24 hours a day at Schlossplatz, just off Unter den Linden. But on October 28th, the birthday will be officially celebrated with a ceremony at Berlin's oldest parish church, which is St. Nicholas in Berlin Mitte. Come dusk, there'll be music, an open-air theater, and huge fire installations, including flaming sculptures, along the River Spree's canals. It's all free and open to the public and takes place between the Schlossplatz and the TV Tower in Berlin's Eastern Center. From Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
And you're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this to find out more an attempt to bring Dutch literature to the English language market from the appropriate environs of Holland Park.
The November issue of Monocle takes the pulse of the world as we investigate how good healthcare makes a nation. We reveal who has the best nurses, meet a mayor who put his city on a diet, and visit a hospital the size of a city. And there's lots more to make you feel better about the world too.
In the business section, we find out about the healthy Japanese tipo that represents a $1.2 billion industry. We take to the skies with the CEO of Australia's Royal Flying Doctor Service, and our Washington correspondent profiles the small businesses making a healthy profit on the US presidential campaign trail.
In the affairs section, we go on the road with an elderly band of diplomats. I sit down with Malaysia's Mr. Fixit, and we also present our 10-point plan for the next US president, whoever that may be.
In the design section, we tackle grey matters, looking at three pioneering projects designed for the elderly around the world. We also create our own perfect community in which to grow old. Elsewhere, we drop in on a beautiful new cancer treatment centre by Nord Architects in Copenhagen that's more like a home than a hospital.
The November issue of Monocle also includes a special expo that limbers up with Japanese companies as they bend knees and reach for better profits with the aid of morning exercise routines. It's all on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's Saturday lunchtime here in London, so that means you must be listening to The Review. Now, the literature of the Netherlands has enjoyed a complicated history, not least due to the rise and fall of various foreign powers such as France and Austria, and religious movements such as the Reformation. But despite the meddling in Dutch culture by pretty much everybody else in Europe, Dutch literature has not yet enjoyed the export success of, let's say, Scandinavia.
However, from a stall in London's Portobello Road market, a small publishing house is striving to change that. The appropriately named Holland Park Press specialises in bringing Dutch language literature to an Anglophone market. It translates works, trains authors and publishes the best the Netherlands have to offer. A little earlier on today, Jesse Roger went to see Bernadette Janssen op de Haar from Holland Park Press at her stall. Jesse began by asking why she felt Dutch literature merited a wider audience.
I choose to do that because there's quite a lot of Dutch authors that write in a style which is very much related to the way writers write here in England. And there weren't many opportunities for them to actually get their books translated because they were doing quite well, but they weren't exactly best-selling yet.
And can you just explain what first brought you here to where we are in Portobello Market?
Well, Portobello Market is my local market. I always go there and I've done a lot of shopping for presents here and I love the market. And I thought it would be good to have more books on the market and that it would be a very good place to meet a lot of people I wouldn't meet otherwise. Because the people who come to the market here are very varied. You know, they're local people from all sorts of backgrounds, but they're also tourists, including Dutch tourists, which in my particular case is of interest.
And what are your favourite three titles that you currently have at Holland Park Press?
Oh, that is very difficult. I'll start with the most recently launched ones. One is called Finding Southbeck by an award-winning South African writer, Karen Jennings. She's just about to turn 30, so she's still quite young. And this book is really a very important book because it tells you what life is like in modern, current South Africa. And through a set of interlinked relationships between a husband and a wife and a foundling they take into their home, and the fact that they live in a divided town, you get a good idea that even though things have moved on in South Africa, for some of the poor people, things haven't changed that much. When Karen tried to get it published in South Africa, because you would think that would be the most obvious thing to do, no one wanted to accept it because they wanted to give it a happy ending. And she said, no, the book is as it is, and there isn't quite a happy ending yet, so I'm not going to write that in the book.
That's an interesting approach to writing books. How about your second title that you would recommend to our listeners?
We publish both poetry and fiction, and this is a poetry title. And we actually launched it on Wednesday and Thursday at Manchester and Lancaster Literature Festivals. And it's by an English writer based in Manchester called Rosie Garland. And the poetry collection is about her struggle with cancer, and she actually is clear now, so she survived it, and she wrote poems about that. And then you would think, oh, this is very sad and terrible,
but actually it's very uplifting. As Rosie says herself, there's two words I hate, brave and tragic, because I'm neither brave nor tragic. And another wonderful thing about this poetry collection, which is called Everything Must Go, is that you can read it as you can read a novel. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You're there when she gets first the diagnosis that she has cancer. She is a singer, she is a performer, and has her voice is very important, and then she has throat cancer. And then she takes you on her journey in hospital, and finally to the fact that she can say, but I'm clear now. And it's a wonderful story, and it makes people laugh and cry. I've seen that now several times, and it's really wonderful.
And could you walk me through your third choice?
My third choice is Angel by Arnold Janssen op de Heij. If you wonder about the coincidence of the name, he is indeed my brother. And he also acts as my literary advisor for Dutch literature. Angel is a wonderful novel about a writer who feels not very happy in living in a very small provincial town where everyone knows him. And then he wins the lottery and decides to run away. Lots of people want to run away, but in this case he does run away. He goes to Spain, and then he also goes here to London. It actually has a scene here in Portobello Market. There's also some curious incident in the Royal Box in the Opera House, which I cannot divulge because I give away the plot. And eventually he ends up a very remote Scottish island. So it's really a journey of finding out who you are, and can you actually escape yourself? You actually can't. However far you run away, some things keep coming back. And that's what this story is about. An extra special thing here is that this is the only book I have also translated. I don't do that much translation. I love it, but I don't have the time for it. But this particular book I've also translated.
And your final title?
It's a very fun title. It's called Top of the 60s by David Ayres. And it's about growing up in the 1960s in a small West Midlands town. And when you read it and you think back at it and think, oh, how innocent people were then. They thought they were really avant-garde. They were into pop music because that was just starting. But actually they were so conventional and so naive. But it's just fun to read. And these are short stories. So you can see from the titles here, we do novels, short story collections and poetry, and that really sums it up.
And is there something that typifies the Dutch writing style for you?
Not really. It's actually quite varied, although here in the UK we mostly hear from probably the western part of the country and not so much from the south and the east, which is slightly cultural different.
And is the interaction between the reader and the author something that's important to you?
Yes, that's very important. And that's why we mostly sell direct to the customer. So we sell on the market here, where you actually see the customer. We sell through events and we sell through our website. And that's actually one of the special things about Holland Park Press, that we try to, as much as possible, sell directly to the customer.
Finally, is the craft of making a book important to you, and making a unique and precious kind of product something that you prize?
Yes, very much so. It's not just about publishing a good story. Of course, it has to be a good story, but it also has to tell something more. And that more makes it literature. And I mean by that, that the writer had to feel that the book had to be written. It was absolutely essential that the words were put onto paper. And also, you should be able to read a book on different levels. On the top level is the story, but underneath it might say something about society or about relationships between people, about a political situation even. Although you don't have to pick that up, but you can. So it's multi-layered, the fact that it had to be written, and the fact that it will have a very long life, because a really good book remains a good book, even if it's 100 years old. And actually some of the books we publish are classics, which are indeed 100 years old or more.
That was Bernadette Jansen op der Haar from Holland Park Press, who published Dutch writing here in London. You can find all of their titles on their website.
And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from us here at Midori House. The programme was produced by Katie Bilboa. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell. And special thanks also to Jesse Roger.
And you don't have to wait until next Saturday for more cultural programming from Monocle 24. Here's what's coming up on Monday night on The Culture Show with Robert Bound.
First up, we head to the CMJ Music Marathon in New York City to talk music business. We also meet the Cape Town scholar who's given himself the impressive task of translating Homer's Iliad into South African English, and we'll visit one of Berlin's most bizarre museums, the Design Panopticum.
That's culture editor Robert Bound. His show premieres at 1900 hours London time on Monday.
We're handing back over to Louise Banbury, who is poised to bring you the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guest features on the curator as well. She'll also be joined at 1400 hours London time in the studio by the renowned New Zealand author C.K. Stead. But from us on the review, goodbye.